And I wish I could find a way for that custom overlay to fade to my face instead of just flicking to my face. But, you know, it's a free service. Welcome to the Lean Into Art Show, a weekly show where, well, weekly? We're going to talk about that in a second, where a couple of visual storytellers get together and talk about some potentially difficult concepts. We usually start with a curveball, try to warm ourselves up intellectually, try to challenge the other, stump the other guy. And then we take on the main topic. We zoom out 10,000 feet up and look at it from an abstract point of view, and then go back down on the ground and try to find a more practical application of this concept that we've been discussing. And we close out with some takeaways from our week making art. My name is Jersey Drozd, and the other guy is...
I am Rob Stenzinger. Hey, other guy.
Hey, you're the other guy. Oh, you're the dummy. You're the dummy. You're the dummy. Good to see you, Rob.
If we could only have Red Fox on the show. Mm-hmm. Anyway. Nobody could say dummy like Red Fox. Yep.
Ryan Estrada is in the chat, and I'm wondering how good his Red Fox impersonation is. Given that he's done some acting in the past. By the way, okay, this is where we got to kick off before we go into curveballs. Did you see the news that Ryan Estrada posted about how he's directing a play of, he's directing Hamlet, but it's a very specific version of Hamlet. Did you see this?
No, I heard about the Hamlet thing. But I didn't realize what's the curve on this thing?
Okay, so Ryan North is doing a Kickstarter, and I haven't looked at it recently, but I'm sure it's funded by now. But it's to make a choose-your-own-adventure book of Hamlet.
Oh, no, that's
and
cool.
Here's where it gets awesome. I mean, it's already awesome, but here's where it gets into, like, Shaolin soccer explosion behind me awesome, is Ryan Estrada is directing a play version of the book, Choose Your Own Adventure Play, where it's going to be streamed live and you can chime in to determine what direction the play goes in.
No way. That's the best. So wait, when does this happen? Like, I need to put it on my calendar.
Yeah, Ryan, if you can help us out in the chat, let us know exactly when it is. I can look it up later for the show notes too. But yeah, I don't think the Kickstarter is finished yet. So if you want to chip in on it to make this book a reality, everything about this just sounds like so much fun. Ugh. But yeah, the joyous madman of comics, RyanEstrada.com.
A choose your own adventure play. God, that's super cool. So yeah, okay, neat. Let me I don't know if you're looking for any I would love to hear some of the behind the scenes on that sometime, Ryan. Maybe we need to, you know, interview him again or something.
I think we do.
Yeah.
I think we do. Cool. I think we can cajole him, harangue him and twist his arm into coming back on the show sometime. He's not sure of the date yet. I got him in the chat here. And yeah, the Kickstarter was funded 10 times over. Wow. Well, it's just that there's like the evidence, the proof of if you've got a really, really good idea, you know, you can make it take off. Granted, Ryan North, Dinosaur Comics, Project Wonderful, the guy has a constituency, but, you know, if it was a bad idea, I don't think any constituency in the world will fund it 10 times over.
Yeah, so. Probably not. Or certainly not for a second time.
Yeah. So, okay. So with that, we've got to kick into curveball. No music for this. Let's just dive into it. You didn't have one, right, Rob? So we can just do this lengthy one that I prepared. Hopefully we can keep this under 10 minutes.
You know, I was going to go through my normal brainstorming about, you know, how, you know, what would be something interesting and challenging that I bet Jersey in particular would have, you know, some interesting perspective on this, right? And this one, watch us answer this in now like 30 seconds. But my impression of this was, this might take over the episode.
As we're recording live, this is the wonderful thing about doing a live show is like we could hit our topic, but there's a small chance we might not. No, I think we can blast through this one. I'm going to keep my eye on the clock for this one.
Okay.
So Brandon Dayton, who of BrandonDayton.com, always posts wonderful, wonderful things online. He's a great person to follow, whether it's on Twitter, Facebook, or Google Plus or whatever. And he posted an article called How Rejection Breeds Creativity. Now, Rob, I'm certain you didn't have time to read this yet because I just shared this link with you like this afternoon.
I did skim it, actually.
Oh, did you? Okay. So
yeah.
You got the gist of it?
Mm-hmm. I can't believe they made a study out of this. It's actually a pretty brilliant and insightful from what I, you know, admittedly glanced over. Do you want me to try to attempt a summary, or would you like to?
I could just really quick, the big idea of it is, and it's one of those obvious common sense things when you think about it, is that when you are rejected, meaning whether you put something out there and people don't respond to it, or you submit something to a publisher or an editor and they turn you down, you have an opportunity for two different responses to that. You can either say, "Oh, nuts, woe is me. I guess I suck at this thing after all." Or you can say, to heck with them. I'm going to show everybody that this is a good idea, and I'm going to find a way to make everybody understand how great this idea is, right? And the study has proven that taking the latter reaction actually boosts your creativity, because you engage in problem solving. And it comes down to this kind of interpreting yourself either as somebody who was meant to be part of the group but was kicked out, or if you are the rugged individualist who will blaze your own path, right? And this definitely appeals to me with my whole fascination with the Western outlook of taking the, you know, your own path through the forest adventurous and all that kind of crap. And so Brandon shared this just in the nick of time for me, because I was listening to the Build and Analyze show on the 5x5 network, which I'll link to in the show notes. And one of the things they discussed in that episode, and I don't think they meant it this way, but they kind of hit this point and then moved on from it really quick, which I felt was kind of a missed opportunity to dig deeper, is they said to summarize, he basically said, it's pointless to be great at something if nobody wants what you're great at, which hits a pain point for me. Right? It's a pain point, because it makes me wonder, gosh, I've been at this thing a long time, and I think I'm pretty good at it, and I have people who I respect who tell me that I'm good at it, but I don't make any money at it. So maybe the thing I'm making, as good as I am at it, ultimately doesn't serve anybody. It's not what anybody wants, right? And that's, how often do you feel like that, Rob?
Let's see. Are we, what's our unit of measurement? Is it minute, day, week? I've actually pretty often, but my relationship with that has changed over the last probably year or so. I think a critical component of this is that, well, let's see, something happens as an event. Does this event keep recurring? How do you deal with it? Do you deal with it as like on a systemic basis, where you see this as like part of an overall thing that you're building with an evolving kind of outcome and all that? Or is it a just an all-encompassing event? Like everything that it'll ever mean, it means right now. And that will be, you know, you're creating a severe fork in the road for what you're about to do next, kind of thing. In other words, if you go up to someone and you show them your art and they laugh at you and then you quit, then you'll never have a chance to get better. But if you see it as, well, this is a point, and you don't have to be necessarily hyper resilient and willing to be, I'm the individualist, watch me do my own thing, but you can choose to still keep at it anyway. And then that, what's in it, and then the build and analyze example is like a different way to measure that whole process. So in that system, I think Marco Arment and Dan Benjamin were referring to, I think it had to do with the, well, it's a business thing. It's a business machine that they were talking about. Like, so as a bit of feedback, if you're not making money in that thing, you're not in a business.
Yes. So. Yes. And yeah, that to be fair to them, they were also talking about this idea of, well, like you said, measurement. I lost my point there. But yeah, to be entirely fair, I was taking something completely out of context. And they even said, like, if you just enjoy doing it as a hobby, that's fine. But if you want to make a business out of it, then you've got to adjust. And they were really kind of leaning on this idea of giving people what they want. But then it raises the question of, what if, and this was in that article that Brandon linked to, is that sometimes you're ahead of the time, right? and you know what the people want before they necessarily know what they want. And there's a danger in being ahead of the times, right? If you're too far ahead of the times, that means you're one of those lovely people who die penniless, and then people build a cottage industry on discussing your stuff decades or centuries after your death and decrepitude, where you're thrown into a ditch in a bag, right? Is what a lovely romantic idea that is. So the big question is, and I'm hoping we can address this in 5 minutes.
Okay.
How do you know when to quit and try something else? We've examined the two opposite ends of the spectrum or opposite points of view on this. Like the article Brandon linked to suggests that, well, just keep trying and let your inner creativity come out and you see yourself as that rugged individualist and you will persevere. And then the Marco Arment example said that, there's no glory in working hard on something that is fruitless, right? And I see the validity on both sides of that argument.
Can I paint another extreme? So in the Marco Arment situation, I think what one that he's leaving out is there is an extreme of chasing the easy money. And I don't think he's done that. I don't think he was endorsing that necessarily either. And I know I'm not trying to paint that you are. It's but I think that's a further point, a further extreme than what he was describing is to not include your taste at all and completely define what you're providing as a service based on what is easy for you to have access to. So that means you have access.
Werewolf romance vampire fiction is hot. get in on this. There's a buck to be made, right?
Yeah, werewolf, zombie, pony.
Historical figure, insert historical figure, right?
Yeah, Abe Lincoln in particular. And which, anyway. Okay, so I will try to honor the 5 minutes. But I do think it's an extreme where a lot of, we have our foot in a few different zones here that I think makes the question difficult to answer, because what is your motivation? Is your motivation to, serve your own skill set and sense of joy and pleasure from the creative process? Probably that has something to do with sharing it with an audience, but then there's a spectrum between having a small audience that you're pleasing and then having enough of an audience that's willing to engage and trade with you to make it a business venture that funds your life. You know, I think those are pretty different criteria, and depending on where we stand, I think it changes the answer.
So in other words, it depends.
I was trying to be more specific than that. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think what you're pointing at, to rephrase it a little bit, not to say that you were being imprecise, but just in case anybody doesn't get it, is that some serious self-honesty comes into this, right? You really do have to understand what you want. And you know, a question that I get a lot from people who listen to the stuff that I do or come see me at workshops is they'll phrase it, how do you get famous? How do I get famous like you, Jersey? First of all, yes, you know, let's table that rejoinder. But then second of all is that, what do you mean by famous? Let's define that real quick so then we can actually figure out how to actually get to what you're talking about here. You could be famous by doing an awful lot of things. Not all of them good. So.
Yeah. Again, so it depends on what you want. So for you, what really resonated with you as far as, like what you're thinking about, how you're framing up the problem, Jersey?
Well, you mean like to my specific problems?
Yeah, where you, it sounded like this really resonated. Yeah, like you were like, oh man, okay, look at this.
Well, I'll tell you, and this is kind of a prelude to next week's episode where we're going to talk about reflecting and evaluating on a year gone by. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I've been continuously struggling with for probably about, I would say, 3 to 4 years now is... what do I want out of this comics jazz? What do I want out of this comics jazz in a way that will make me money? how can I finally make my comics, the personal comics projects, be the majority of my money? And this is a big problem. This is a problem that many, 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 many cartoonists have. I make my money through teaching and through doing freelance art. That's 100% of how I make my living. I make almost $0 off of my comics. My personal comics. I've done comics for money for other people. But how can I come up with a project that is both personally satisfying, not to say that my freelance work isn't, but something where I can be completely creatively free and it makes a reasonable amount of money so I don't have to take on freelance work anymore, right? Mm-hmm. And so when you do that kind of thinking, you think about a lot of things. You think about, well, I just need to make this particular book, name your project. I need to do this weekly, potentially 3 times a week, and I just got to push really hard. And if I push really hard for 2 years, it's going to pay off, right? And then, you know, I think about that thing Marco Arment suggested, and I'm like, oh, crap, you know, that's not necessarily a good thing. How do I measure it? How do I evaluate it? How do I even know? You don't know. You have to make sure that it's just a project that feels good to you and then push that passion into it, right? And then I think about how, I think about what's going on in different markets. What is catching on? What are the things where how could I design a project that I could either leverage as a web thing, or if a publisher comes along, I can leverage it that way. And that influences my thinking in terms of like, well, you know, when I look at the front and I think that there's no way in this or any other lifetime, any publisher is going to pick that book up, because as much as I love it, and I do love it very much, I think it is conceptually a mess. It is just this big dumping ground for everything that I love, and I don't have the one sentence pitch that I can give to a publisher that makes them say, oh, it's for this specific audience, right?
You're pointing at a lot of things of why I think this is a deep topic, and if we chose to, we probably could make an entire podcast series about it, much less this single one. Yes. What you're describing is a really key challenge that I think a lot of us face when you're building some kind of trade off of the things that you care to build. Mm-hmm. And the trade aspect of it is a different problem than the building aspect of it. The trade aspect of it has to do with the distribution and the awareness within the audience and helping them make the choice to then engage in consuming the thing that you made through the distribution method that you chose to put it through. And it's very complex. And no, thanks. And on top of it, there's another angle that is super. So I'm just throwing bookmarks out that welcome to a whole bunch more episodes of the Lean Into Artcast, basically. Another bookmark is the whole thing where you said it's that this is my paraphrasing, that it's really hard for an audience to understand something that is too new, that is not familiar. And it's our job. If it depends on what your job, how you look at your job. If your job as an artist is to thrill and excite people that are alive today while you're alive, you're probably going to need to find a way to relate to those people that gets that. So you're dealing with the distribution thing and all that. Yet you want to make sure that you're also not distorting and, you know, hurting the thing that you create that you care about and whatnot. So there's this mapping exercise that goes on, and my big cheat for that, well, this isn't like, I deal with this all the time in doing user experience design, yet I'm not able to really apply it to my other creative pursuits as well. I mean, I've had success, but nothing, you know, like I feel good about what I've done with Guitar Fretter, but like I'm not paying my mortgage based on Guitar Fretter, you know? Yeah. We have to care about that and recognize that there's a chasm between us and our audience and the thing we made. We have to somehow get it across that. And so for me, when I'm doing user experience designs that are like, well, gosh, you know, our business has never done blank before, even if blank has existed for a decade, well, everyone has different focuses and it just didn't come across their radar, whatever. So some things are new, then some things are like months old. And whether in either case, this bridging has to happen, because what matters is what the audience knows and what they don't know. And you have to figure out a way to help bring that across. So you involve them, and that's where you can do, when it comes to comics, now here I go with a blank, fill in the blank, like, cause I haven't figured that out for this area, right? Where when it comes to designing software, you present prototypes, you have brainstorm collaborative sessions that you I mean, you can work through so everyone feels like they're a part of it, but inherently your audience probably isn't part of creating your comic, probably, unless you're Ryan Estrada and you're doing stuff like Choose Your Own Adventure, you know, plays and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, it's, there's got to be a way to bridge that gap with your particular audience. And when you do, that's what people pay for. It's when you get into their world, they pay for access to things and they pay for convenient access to things in particular. For instance, I would have made nothing off of Guitar Fretter if I chose just to iterate on the web live, in my opinion. But since I chose to do that in a way that went to a convenient device through an app market that people are comfortable with paying and all that. Anyway, I included that as part of the success for the project. And I know we blew past the 5 minutes, but I don't know. Let's see, I was trying, Jersey. I was trying
for
it.
I know. We went a little about 4 or 5 minutes over, but that's okay. It is a footnote to that. Ryan Estrada threw in Werewolf Romance didn't make him rich. I forgot. Yes, The Kind, which is Ryan Estrada's graphic novel. It's a great graphic novel. It's a digital file. You can really get cool. It at thewholestory.com, ryanestrada.com. I wasn't thinking of The Kind when I was talking about where I was thinking actually of, I once knew somebody who read Harlequin Romance style novels about werewolves with the ravished woman on the cover and the werewolf holding her, which, yeah, it was weird. I guess that's a thing. Well, so much then for curveballs. What we can do is we can dog ear that one for January for some early 2013 shows, because I think it would actually be a worthwhile endeavor to dig into the idea of using the software creation model as a thinking exercise to figuring out how to communicate your comic's value to the people who would find that value. I think that'd be an interesting discussion to have. So, okay.
Sounds awesome.
Okay, well then, are you ready?
Of course, man.
All right, well then, I'm ready. Oh, what's this? We're flying at 10,000 feet up. And we're going to discuss the topic of the week, holiday art wish list. That almost sounds like a Japanese game show.
I suppose we just wheeled out prizes, which were happened to be a bunch of empty shelves. Sorry, everyone.
Super holiday art wish list. So, the holidays are upon us at the time of this recording. And I was thinking about it as I was trying to put together the topic for this week's episode. And I thought, I've found myself doing a lot of, you know, online bookmarking and adding things to wish lists of like, oh, that'd be good for this person. That'd be good for that person. We're buying a lot of stuff. And then I also noticed I caught myself saying to my wife, this particular pen, that particular pen is getting a little weak, a little rusty. Great. You know, Xmas idea, it's right around the corner. You could replace some of these art tools that I need. It'd be useful and it'd be thoughtful. Dropping a lot of hints like that. And I thought, well, you know, this would be a good opportunity to do a big dump of what are our, for the cartoonist who's wondering, I was also thinking about this. Like, you know, we just finished November, big month of creative challenges. You had NaNoWriMo. You had the 30 characters challenge with Tyler James over at 30characters.com, I think.
Yes.
Before that, wasn't there another one? There was 24-Hour Comic Day, which you participated in. So yep. We just came off all these big challenges. We're about to enter this period of reflection and evaluation of how our year went and doing all sorts of resolutions for the next year of production. This is the time to fill the arsenal, right? To gear up, to gird oneself for the next years of challenges. And some of these challenges that you want to take on in the next year, upon learning what you did from November, might be taking on new kinds of art tools, new kinds of equipment, new kinds of approaches to making your art. And that's why I thought a holiday wish list episode where we discuss all the tools that we can't live without, maybe a few of the tools that we're looking forward to trying out. You know, here are some things that I'm hoping that somebody special in my life or somebody anonymous on the internet wants to purchase for me this holiday season. I will say that a lot of these things that we're going to talk about are going to be linked in the show notes, and I took care to gather some Amazon affiliate links for these, so even if you don't get me a gift this holiday season, a great way you can thank the show is by whatever you purchase using those links, because then we get a little bit of a kickback. It adds nothing to the cost for you, but it gives a kickback to the art, to the Lean Into Art show, to, you know, as being a the person who pointed you at the site, referral links and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, but we have to start 1,000 feet up, and in evaluating new tools and looking at, you know, all these holiday wish lists and trying to decide what's the right tool for me, you have to pick the right tool for you. And I'm sure it would come as no surprise to anybody listening that my attitude is that the right tool for you does not mean that it's the right tool for everybody, right? It's like you, going back 20 years, it's like, well, this is what professional cartoonists use. And you still see this at like stores like Michael's, like those little crummy art stores or the chain art stores like the Hobby Lobby. It'll be like, you know, professional manga artist / comic artist starter kit. And it'll have like some Bristol, a couple different brushes, some crow quills, and et cetera, right? Suggesting that this is the right set of tools, right?
Yeah, it's what's really funny is honestly, as I'm listening to you, I'm not that I take an exact copy lesson from these examples, but in a way, I'm tying this what you're describing right now to our curveball topic, and I'm thinking like, are these what the comic artists that are making money, the one, you know, like more money, where they figured out, right? I mean, someone got hired to illustrate that thing, and to oppose is like, haha, I'm the professional manga comic, you know, awesome.
So what you're saying is we need to create the Lean Into Art starter kit.
Well, perhaps. We do have a question that I don't think we've answered yet that I want to get to, where someone did ask, and we referred to it again too, before, where someone asked us like, how do I join the Lean Into Art movement? Right?
Buy our kit.
Yeah, well, no, and I don't, it, what's funny is maybe, yeah, but.
I love how you waffled around that one, maybe.
I'm just going to put this idea out there. I'm not going to force it. No, yeah.
I'll think about it over the holidays.
Yeah, anyway. So yeah, there's. What's funny is like even Michael's, I think it reminds me, I've received like some gift packs from that kind of store before, where it's just sort of like, I'm trying to remember. Was it? It's not Pentel. It's the Faber-Castell like set of brush markers and some here's what the fancy artists use. And, you know, it was a whole lot of packaging and not that many tools.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I got exposed to brush pens.
No, I'm not going to completely dump all over the idea of those starter kits. I mean, as I'm getting a little older, I'm mellowing out about a few interesting things that used to really set me off. Like those starter kits used to really make me mad because it suggested that there was one vector into doing it. You know, it was as if you're giving a kid a page with pre-drawn panels on it and said, make some comics. And man, that just, in my opinion, stunts the whole idea of creativity. But at the same time, you know, I've also gone into this whole jag about how limitations breed creativity. The right kid is going to work with those tools and find interesting new ways to use them, not just go, well, this is how the masters do it after all. Mm-hmm. Comic Life is another one that used to really just push my buttons, really got me fired up. You know, that application, Comic
Life. Oh, yeah. Yeah, we've talked about that before on air.
Yeah.
A few times.
I'm not so mad about it anymore. I see how it can be an entry point into comics, but as long as it's an entry point, or unless you find some brilliant new use for it, like some way to use that it wasn't intended for, to find new modes of storytelling. So that's how I'm mellowing out. Is I'm starting to realize that, well, everything's an opportunity for creativity, providing the right person gets their hands on it. So back to this idea of how do you find the right tools for you, Rob?
Mm-hmm.
How do you do it? I mean, you just buy everything and then just try it every day. Try a different one. Monday is going to be my crow quill day. Tuesday is going to be my Bic ballpoint pen day. And then eventually it's just going to click.
Well, I don't necessarily look at what's funny is sometimes it's because I've received gift packs before as gifts. And I'm just like, well, what's in this thing? Let's bust it out. And okay. Oh gosh, what's that? Pastel crayons, whole bunch of pastel crayons. Okay. Let's, let's see what we can do with this.
Sure.
And, but no, when I'm actually thinking of something that I'm on the hunt for, like I got bit by the bug where I'm curious about a thing. A lot of times it comes from seeing an example and wondering how that example was brought about.
Example, what do you mean?
Like, let's see. I'm trying to think of who I ran into that was first using Copic markers. I might have been Mark Rudolph of Art and Story. And I was like, look at that. Very interesting. Because I noticed like two really different kinds of shading he was getting with those things. And I thought, yeah, that sounds fun. And you know, it just didn't look like any other. It made me really curious about a different kind of marker. I thought, isn't a marker a marker? And I was like, okay, I want this thing. I want to try it out.
Yeah.
So went on my wish list.
Yeah, I mean, that is the number one way that I discover new tools is when I see a cartoonist do something interesting that really grabs me. And then the next question is I have to figure out why did it grab me? And this goes back to an old idea it's a drum I've been beating for years, is this idea of the analytic eye. I think the cartoonist properly should be enjoying their entertainment, but simultaneously keeping an eye on for whenever something affects them, whenever something arrests them, either aesthetically or emotionally or what. And the next question is, why did it do that to me? What did they do? Or what do I think they did to make me feel that way? Mm-hmm. And then the next thing you do is investigate it, analyze it, look at it, meditate on it. And so this was when, you know, I've told the story before. For years, I was terrified to use ink in my work. I relied entirely on drawing in pencil. I can't remember, Rob, if when you were here in Michigan, if I showed you any of those pages that I did where I inked in pencil, where I would just draw in pencil really dark.
No, you did not show me those.
Oh, man, I got boxes and boxes of that stuff.
Oh, wow.
But, I mean, I would draw on, like, you know, even on Bristol, you'd be able to run your hand on the other side and feel the lines because I pushed so hard.
What value pencil were you using?
I was just using an HB or sometimes a B, but okay. I was using a 0.9 millimeter mechanical pencil. So one of the chubbier mechanical pencils.
Sure. Yeah.
But I've always been interested in kind of like a cleaner contour line style. Yeah. So even in my old stuff from the 90s, I was trying to do like what looked clean, but I was doing it in pencil because I was afraid to use ink. And then I discovered the work of Masatsuki Yamakami, who I was just consumed by. I mean, the guy's art took over my life for like a full 2 years. And all I could do was stare at it. I'm like, how is he doing this? How is he getting this to look so beautiful? Beautiful. What do you mean by beautiful, Jersey? Well, there's all these really crisp, clean lines, and there's such a great variety of kinds of lines. There's like these wonderful arcs and curves and great line value on the outer contours, but the insides have all these wonderful, light, feathery, chicken scratch lines. Well, how's he doing that? Well, it looks like he's using a crow quill. So I think I'm going to go have to get a crow quill. And he might have been using some other kind of dip pen, but, you know, my guess was crow quill. So I went and got a crow quill pen, and that's what finally got me to try it out. So that's how I've discovered new tools. So like whenever I see somebody like a Craig Thompson who's like, wow, this guy's brush strokes. There's this really cool variety of these really thick, soupy lines. But then there's these wonderfully brittle dry brush effects that he's putting in there. Gosh, I think I'd kind of like to try to do something like that in my work with a brush. Well, time to get a brush. But what do I get? Well, let's get a couple different kinds of brushes and try out what feels right to me. And then I've told this before, too, is just like doing some little test exercises, like instituting something into my day, like a daily sketch kind of thing to teach myself a new tool in a low risk capacity rather than diving into a book. Because like when I learned the crow quill, I dove into a book that was being published, which was really dumb because that really enhanced the anxiety of trying out a new tool.
I've been there. Okay, so what's funny is you brought up another example. Many of the folks in the art and story community were huge inspirations regarding tool choice for me. Mm. So you mentioned, some technique as well, which it's not just sometimes, well, these tools don't exist in a vacuum. So like you needed, I noticed in your daily sketches, you were, you know, doing a lot of, you know, swooping lines and stuff. And I was excited to hear that I don't think you were using a crow quill at that point.
No.
So I'm like, okay, I dig these lines. And I'm pretty sure you're one of the reasons I picked up a brush pen, like the Pentel pocket brush pen.
Oh, that's funny.
And I was like, okay, well, now I got to figure out what paper to use, which I didn't. I decided to cheap out. I didn't go with like a stronger, the your paper option, which I know is in the list and I won't state yet because I don't know. I'm feeling like being a teaser. But the, let's see. I was like, okay, wait a minute. I need to get some kind of cardstock that's available. And I hunted on Amazon and found one. And which I can mention in the when you mentioned your paper too.
Oh, okay. So flag for follow up.
Yeah, I'm trying to like obey the sections too because I love this though. Like we're in the 10,000 foot, and I've already been slipping and mentioning all these tools.
And I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on the section. The big idea here was just and Ryan Estrada actually has a great tip thrown in here is match a tool to a project. That's a great way also. Break in. Okay, this is the project where I'm going to use. And I've done this myself. One of the examples I had listed was. By doing these daily sketches with the brush pen, I took a year to train myself on what I could get out of it, and then finally took on a project where I did the Boulder and Fleet mini comic, which was, I set up, and I've talked about it in other places, I won't bore anybody with this here, but I set up a bunch of different art challenges, but the one that I had licked was, I know I can use a brush pen for this, and this project is specifically designed to avail itself of what the brush pen can give. If I did this with mechanical pens or with crow quills, it wouldn't work right. It wouldn't match the tone of the story. So this comes back to an earlier point, back to curveball, is a really clear self-knowledge and what you want out of not only your career, but a project. What's the aesthetic of this project?
Oh, gosh. And absolutely. Honestly, I really practiced a ton my updated natural media tool set by engaging in the art and story, the mini comics dump truck. Mm. And I ended up doing 4 mini comics.
That is awesome. See, that's another thing. I mean, like we keep coming back to this too. And I think it should be, that bell should be rung a couple more times is mini comics are so great for learning stuff to do, right?
Yes, yes, yes. Because
go ahead.
Tons of magic there because it's and it's not even but it's not the kind of magic where you find out that there's nothing behind it. It's actually it makes a lot of sense. So you have a concise thing to work on that's finishable, and that's incredibly satisfying. And then you can define all sorts of interesting limitations that allows you to finish it beyond it being perhaps small in size or whatever. But you know what? There's nothing determining your production process. It ends up being a mini comic, but it's still flexible. How many pages, what size you put into it, whatever. So what's amazing is like, it may sound prescriptive at first, but you still get to really fine tune the recipe to throw in those things that like you want to try. One of the things I tried is, let's see, was a 24-hour comic day in like 2011. A local art supply place called Wet Paint. If you're in the Twin Cities area, I highly recommend checking them out. They're really cool and super supportive of the comics community locally. They gave us these huge sheets of Bristol, which I haven't drawn huge since high school, right? Yeah. And I'm like, you know what? One of these mini comics, that's it. I'm using this huge paper.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah. It's,
yeah. I think that's a good way of just underscoring this idea of that mini comics are so great because it can be an experimental thing where you can fine tune your recipes and add new things to the mix in a low risk way, but you still got something finished when you're done. I think too many young people or beginning cartoonists I talk to are really, they fetishize this whole graphic novel thing. I'm not for real until I've done one of these, graphic novel, and a mini comic's not real somehow. Boy, I know a lot of really well-respected cartoonists who would, very aggressively disagree with that concept. But anyway, yeah, it, at the very least, it's a fun pool to experiment in. But, to keep the 10,000 feet up part, brief and in respect to the time we've got for the show today, mm-hmm. Really all I wanted to dive at is this idea of we're about to talk about a lot of tools, and I don't want anybody to misunderstand anything that we're about to say in terms of, oh, these are the right tools. These are just a bunch of tools that we are going to examine the pros and cons of, and we wanted to explain our thinking process is to evaluating what tools to take on next, right? Because as you listened to the Art and Story show back in the day, Rob, you remember I was...
A zealot over the crow quill?
I wasn't a zealot. Come on, be fair here.
I'm sorry.
But no, but I was steadfast in my resolution that I would never try a brush. Brush was not for me. I wasn't getting anything. I wasn't doing any project that demanded it or required it. But then a year later, completely changed my mind on it. And I haven't inked anything with the crow quill in some time. And not because I'm done with the crow quill, but just because everything I've been doing really like has benefited from the brush. Ryan Estrada is asking a question in the chat or suggesting something in the chat. Tool suggestion. Do they sell sketchbooks with black paper in the U.S.? They're available everywhere in Korea for like $2. And so great to sketch in since you have to kind of reverse your thinking. Oh.
Oh, yeah. That is super cool. I was gifted actually a pad of that kind of paper. I haven't run into it very commonly, and I went through it a few years back. But yeah, it was a ton of fun to figure out how to. It was actually good paper for those the pastel crayons.
That's interesting. I'm wondering if I should get because Ann and I make sketchbooks. Well, rather Ann makes sketchbooks, and I just use them. I should get her to do one where it's like black construction paper and see what I can get out of that. That would be interesting. Shadowingtronics is in the chat too, and he's saying that I was his influence on getting the Pentel Pocket Pen too. Wow. You know, it's funny. Here's another observation going back to the curveball is when I was doing those daily sketches, I got like next to no feedback. I got a few like at tweets and like, oh, that's cool. Neat. Thumbs up. But I didn't really feel like anybody was watching me doing that at the time. I mean, I referred to them a lot, but I didn't really feel like I had an audience watching that. So it's kind of cool to hear that there was somebody paying attention to those when I was doing them.
I was really stoked about it because I was curious to, you know, explore some of your, it's still on my to-do list, by the way. You posted some blue lines of some artwork ages ago, which would be worth linking to in the show notes. It's still like, I have it in my like projects folder it's like a little play sandbox of things I want to play with that. I just kind of throw stuff in this folder. And they're in there, and I just haven't gotten to them. But
you're talking about I posted like the blue lines for a couple of pieces that I did and challenged people to ink them just to see what
yes.
they look like.
Azula and Beastman.
You know how many downloads that one got?
A ton, I bet.
I think it was like two. It was some. You might have been you and like one, maybe Shadowingtronics did the other one. So that's another reason why I was thinking that nobody's really paying attention to this stuff because I was throwing out challenges that people weren't really responding to. And I'm not making fun of myself here, and I'm not trying to play the pity card. I'm just saying that this is another illustration of how you can be doing something that it seems at the time that nobody's paying attention to, but people are paying attention and being influenced by it. So there we go.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Got a bunch of polite lurkers. That's all.
So do you want to kick into On the Grounds when we actually talk about the tools?
Yeah, please.
Okay, well then here we go. Time to hit the ground running and start discussing some of these tools that we have used or want to use, tools we cannot live without, tools that thrill us, tools that we're addicted to. You can get addicted to some of these things, right?
Yes. I've been wondering sometimes if I am addicted to some of my creative pursuits. So,
because you mentioned a thing in here called the Chubster.
I cannot find that pencil to save my life, but it was one of those things that. It's funny. I bet it was something that my wife gave me like when we were first going out, and like this pencil lasted me like 7 years, and it was my favorite mechanical pencil. But in the course of 7 years, I'm assuming they went out of business because they made such a good pencil, and it just felt perfect in my hands. Like I can't even describe it. Just heavy enough, like but just it was shaped a little bit like this, but not, it was far more streamlined. So I think this is the Chubster, you know, placebo, which is Pentel PhD or anyway.
That's a great one. That's a great point to start on before we dive into the actual blow by blow tool recommendations. Is when you find something you like, buy a lot of them, because manufacturers change their lineups all the time. This is my, you know, number one pencil. I've been using these for going on over a decade. I mean, since the mid 90s, and it's the Pentel Twister Ace mechanical pencil at 0.7 and 0.5 millimeter. And I've got some that I've been using since like 1998. And if anything happens to them, I'll just die. So when I got down to my last one, when they, you know, it's like the plastic isn't meant to last that long. And when one of the ones I had since like 96 finally cracked, I realized I better start building up an arsenal of these things. And I went to digblick.com and found out that, oh, they've only got the 0.7s left. And it doesn't look like they're going to be making these much longer. I didn't see them at the stores anymore. They used to be at every, you know, big box store. So I bought like 20 of them, figuring that, okay, I can get X amount of years out of one of them. So if I get 20, that should get me through the rest of my life. I did a blog post on it on comicsaregreat.com explaining my rationale behind this. And so, yeah, I hoard. I can get, hold on. Blue LEDs, I buy them by, you know, the carton because they may stop making them. And if they stop making them, I don't know what I'm going to do.
I know, it's so amazing because like I seriously I went to an all digital process for probably about, well, I don't actually, maybe not all digital, but anything that would be analog wasn't very refined, and I never used red pencil lead. I didn't use blue pencil lead. I didn't scan my, you know, and I didn't ink on paper and then scan it. I mean, I was doing by and large, like maybe a pencil sketch, scan it, and then do all the rest of the refinement digitally. And since the Mini Comics dump truck of the, you know, doing those four comics, I got a taste now for some of the efficiencies of using some of these analog tools. And it adds steps to my process, but I like the results more. And it is interesting because they're businesses that are, building and distributing all these things. And I don't know. I mean, clearly not always funded enough to weather out, you know, tough economy or something.
Yeah. Well, and then I think part of it is fashion too, right? Because like they still make the Twist Erase pencil that I showed you a second ago, but they changed it to have like one of those gummy tips where it's like flexible at the top end. Which changes the grip entirely, which changes the way it feels. And so it's just not right anymore. It's not right. And I suppose I could get used to it if I have to. But, you know, it's after, you know, going on 20 years of using the same kind of pencil, it hurts to have to make a change in that direction. Okay, let's get through some of these things that, you know, these specific. So, in other words, I can't link to the Pentel Twist Erase pencil because I cannot find these anymore. So I have the last 20. I'm not telling you my address. You can't have them.
Link to your eBay auction.
I wouldn't part with them. I really wouldn't. That's how sick we can get about this stuff.
Well,
we talked about the Pentel Pocket Brush Pen.
Yes. Right?
So this, for those viewers at home, this is the Pocket Brush Pen, which you can get on, you can get it on Amazon. You can get it on dickblick.com, utrek.com. We'll link to it in the show notes for the Amazon link. Basically, it is a paintbrush. Let's see if I can get it into the shot. It's a plastic paintbrush with that you don't have to dip in an inkwell because it's got an ink cartridge built into it, a pressurized ink cartridge that is replaceable. And let's see, what's the price on these guys? $12 gets you the pen with two ink refills. And you can find them at a lot of, like, you know, big box art stores like Hobby Lobby and Michaels as well. Go ahead.
I think $8 to $12, you can get the refill pack of like six.
Yep. And that's what I did too. I bought the pen and then I got a whole mess of refills. Why do I like it? It has a really good hand feel, and plus it's brush. It's waterproof and it's archival, supposedly. And, you know, the great thing about brush, as many people said, is you can get, like, this razor fine line and you can get beautiful thick lines. And then if you also, you know, dab it on a blotter card next to you, you can get some really nice dry brush effects. I'd also throw the color brush pen in for that as well. Does the same thing, and it's got the replaceable cartridge in the back. This one is like $7, and I've even found it at Target of all places, which is really surprising. So both of these are really, really great for sketching, but you can also use them for professional inking as well. Rob, I'll kick over to you. What's one that you've got?
Oh, let's see. Actually, this pencil that I use is the Papermate PhD. I think I said the Pentel. It's Papermate PhD. And I actually love the fat grip. It was the Chubster that got me on this path, because I used to just use the straight up, oh gosh, what's the company that makes the green pencils? I would just get a range of values of, lead pencils and, you know, traditional wood pencil that you need a sharpener and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Totally can't remember the company's name, but eventually I switched to, you know, because of the Chubster, switched to all mechanical all the time.
Yeah, same here. I never use wooden pencils. I used to use the non-photo blue wooden pencils for my penciling, but I've trained myself on how to use these pencils to you know, as I'm penciling, slowly turning it so that I got a consistent point on the lead and I don't have to sharpen them, and I can just, you know, it's a nice plastic thing that just plastic. That's not such a good idea for the environment, probably, but you know.
Well, if you keep it your whole life.
Yeah, if I keep it my whole life, this isn't going into a landfill for at least another 20 years. But anyway, so.
Just got that joke. Okay.
Comics is a hard row to hoe. In addition to, I'm going to be a big ad for Pentel, as I always am, and only because I love their products, is the Pentel Click Eraser. I mean, this is my, I keep... one of these high polymer white erasers. These are great because they don't tear up the paper. They get rid of the blue line and the graphite really, really well. But they're imprecise. And if you need to take care of some tiny details, if you draw small, as I do sometimes, these Click Erase erasers are terrific. It's the same material. It's the same plastic high polymer material, but it's got a little clicky thing, and it extends the eraser as you need it, and then you just refill them. Once I bought the holder, I bought a whole mess of refills, so I've been using this particular holder for probably about 8 years now. So that's my eraser combination. And then the final one I would put in for penciling and inking . I recently switched my lead hardness in the last couple years. I use Pentel high polymer super lead 0.7 millimeter 2B. I use a softer lead nowadays. And I'm finding that's really great for when you want to, if you're somebody like me who actually does like a little bit of minimalist line value on your pencils. Anybody who's seen my pencils, they tend to be a little bit on the crisp side, and I tend to rough in some of the line value that I intend to do with ink at the penciling level. And these are great for that because you can shave down one side of the lead to like this long blade, which will get so you can easily just with a little bit of a angling of the pencil, right? Mm-hmm. So like if I'm going like this, I'm gonna get like perpendicular to the paper, I'm gonna get a razor thin line, but then now I got a nice big fat line. So
wow.
The softer leads tend to work really great for that, but they smudge like crazy. But if you're like me and you work primarily in digital inks nowadays, smudging isn't such a problem. But I adore the 2B leads. And now when I pick up a pencil, if it's got HB in it, I'm like, what is the deal with this lead? It's so brittle. So, yeah. What's the price on these things? I just want to grab the price real quick. $2 to $4.
Have you found like a soft blue lead? Or have you only found a hard blue lead?
The Pentel blue leads I use, yeah. Which it's the high polymer blue leads. It tends to be, compared to HB, it's softer. It's softer than HB, but it's not as soft as B or 2B. It's a little bit on the brittle side.
Because the brittleness, oh my gosh. Yes. I have to like be in a different state of mind when I am using those blue pencil leads, because otherwise you hear click, you know, then I go click, 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 let out some more, click, click it out some more. And then, you know, a swear word or two, and then I, you know, take a deep breath, and then I can start drawing with those out of ham-fisted mode.
Working with mechanical blue leads completely changed the way I pencil. I used to pencil really roughly. I mean, like, I was really hard on that paper. And there were many times where when I was working with an inker, he'd be inking my pages and be like, dude, you've got to stop creating these Martian channels on the page, because when I'm inking, it's getting caught up in all of these, you know, ghosted pencil lines that you grooved into there. When I switched to using mechanical blue leads, I had to use such a delicate stroke that I believe it actually made my figure drawing a little bit more graceful, because in being more physically delicate and putting the lines down, I tended to put down a lot more lines investigating where that final line was going to be. You know, like that whole idea of like you sketch because you're throwing down 50 bad lines to find that one good line. Whereas when I was drawing hard and drawing harder, I was saying, this is the line. I'm putting it down. That's the line. I'm saying that's the line, even if it's the wrong line, right? So I think it actually benefited my penciling to work lighter like that. I don't know. That's my guess.
Cool. That is a really good benefit. And they certainly do train you.
They do.
Lest you just chew up lead.
You do. That is a warning to throw out to people who want to use the blue or the red leads, is that you do need to work with a light touch. But I do think it's a good thing. I mean, I think there'll be some long-term benefits in training yourself to work a little bit lighter in your sketching. It graced up my stuff quite a bit.
Cool. So, no, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense.
So what else you got on your list?
You live without. What can't I live without? So here's what's funny. Now I'm going to just kind of throw a loop at you. I can't live without the idea of, if I come up with something that I want to tackle, I love this current approach, because I discovered it in, you know, wanting to do four mini comics, and I, you know, sort of shopped around and did some fine tuning during that process. But like, I could live without all of it, because I could just go full digital.
Yeah.
But I would prefer not to. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so not to get weird and pedantic, but I think it's neat to discover those things where it's like, oh, okay, I don't know. That's a neat distinction for me, because there's a lot of stuff where I just like, I'll adapt. I'll do a workaround, because I do it all the time in software, right? I mean, I'll work around it. There's a bug in this thing. It's just common. Yeah. So I kind of have that outlook on my art as well.
I was being, you know, playful with this language of can't live without. Yes, I am hooked on these Pentel pencils, but if the worst were to happen and, you know, a thief comes in and takes everything out of my house or all my Pentel pencils at any rate, I'd find another way to do what I want to do.
You would hunt him down.
No, and especially, okay. I mean, like, as I've been, one of the things that will come up next week is this whole idea of one of the things I was training myself to do, using you and Ryan Estrada as inspiration, is training myself to work in a variety of places rather than being a slave to my precious art desk. I'll have more to report on that next week.
Cool.
And tools come into that as well. I want to blast through a few more of these. What were you going to say?
Okay. Well, so something that I do love, I'll mention the, are we on pen still, or I want to
jump all over, man. We've got three categories here. We've got hardware, software, and services that we're
doing. All right, cool. So I really dig this paper I found on Amazon, and it's the Wausau paper, exact index, 110 pound, index card paper. I find it's awesome to print. If I'm doing like a small, let's see, 92 brightness, a small run a run of mini comics that don't have a high page count, I'll use it for every page. If it has a higher page count, I might actually just use it for the cover. And I love sketching on it. So I do most of my original stuff on that now.
I think that's cool. That's cool, because I'm eager for us to hear from more cartoonists who have broken away from Bristol. Bristol is great as an art board. But, you know, Jake Parker, when he was on the Comics Are Great show a while back, he was telling me that he uses like a Hammer Mill color copy card stock for his comic art boards. You know, it's just, he gets it at Staples. And how cool is it when an art supply can be a commodity like that? So you get it cheaper. You can get it in bulk. You don't have to worry about it going away anytime soon. Whereas with, one of the things I ran into with Strathmore Bristol was they were changing their formula somehow, and I was getting batches of it, and it was inconsistent. Where, you know, sometimes the tooth was different, the fibers were different on it. And it's like, I'm paying premium dollars for this stuff. And I got to worry about, you know, your manufacturing process affecting the final output, you know. But when I go get some, you know, just run-of-the-mill copy paper, it's usually pretty consistent.
Yeah, that's true. But it's neat, though. Like, I really love that. That I mean, so you've honed, and I have in some circumstances, but I probably not as in not as many categories. You've honed such a strong preference based on just this really deep familiarity with that given tool. And I think that's a powerful skill.
It sounds cooler than it is. It's me just going like, oh, look at this, too bad. They've got the paper fibers going in the wrong direction.
Okay.
It just turns me into that guy, you know?
I'll throw another "it depends" out there then.
And well, you know, no, it doesn't depend in certain respects. Because, yeah, there are situations where I was working on a wraparound cover for a book that was being published. I was on a tight deadline. I didn't have time to screw up. And then I broke out a sheet of this Bristol, the Strathmore Bristol that I bought, and I threw down my first ink line because I was inking on the pencils back then. I wasn't scanning and printing out blue lines. This is 10 years ago. And I threw down that first ink line and went, oh, no, because the fibers were all messed up on that one. And every line bled like crazy. Every line on this image. There was like 20 characters on the cover. As a matter of fact, I was just checking to see if I have the book behind me someplace. I won't bother to look for it. But yeah, it was like 30 characters. It was this awesome wraparound cover. But there was so much digital post-ops on it because... the paper was a really bad consistency, and I didn't notice it until I threw down that first ink line. So, but I do still love the Utrecht house brand Bristol, which I've talked about many times. I'm only bringing it up here because we're going to collect these in the big link dump in the show notes for the episode. And what I love about the Utrecht house brand Bristol is it is Bristol, but it's a slightly lighter stock. It's a little bit more flexible. I buy them in huge 23x29 sheets, which I cut down to whatever size I need. I can get about 5 sheets of 9x14 penciling paper, you know, about this big. Like, this is like my preferred size to draw comics on. And I can get about 5 sheets of that out of it, or 3 sheets of 11x17, or 4 sheets of this special size that I've concocted to be screen aspect ratio, 1024x768. But it's also great for doing, you know, like little daily sketches on it. It takes ink lines really well. Mm-hmm. And you can push it through an inkjet printer really easily. It doesn't jam. Whereas with Strathmore, Bristol, the 2-ply 300 series, it always jams in my inkjets. And I've heard from other people that it jams in theirs as well. You have to buy in big boxes of 100. You can get pads too, but you get an awesome price break if you buy them in the big boxes. So I buy like 1 or 2 boxes a year for about $150, $140. Here's the tip. Sign up for the Utrecht mailing list, and they send out big sales and coupons all the freaking time. So the last box I got like 30 or 40% off. I got it at a really steep discount because I just jumped on it when the coupon came in my inbox. So I don't mind getting spammed by them because it's usually to let me know about an awesome deal going on the site. So
that's a good tip.
Papers. Speaking of paper, I've got another one. And this one I got earlier this year because of you. And that is the Write in the Rain index card wallet, which this thing is just awesome. So what it is it's a wallet that also has a hardback that you can stick a index card on to take notes in. And then it can also hold some index cards in the middle, and it can hold a little tiny pencil. And whenever I'm off to meetings and I don't want to be the guy who breaks out the iPad and clumsily types on that thing to capture notes, I grab everything on index cards, take pictures of them, drop them into my Evernote, and there's that wonderful optical character recognition in Evernote, so you can easily search all of your past notes. So, yeah, this thing is $30, but it is a really, really great tool to have on hand.
That is cool. That is a big improvement over the one that I use. I mean, I really like it still, but oh yeah, here it is. It's oh gosh, I'm trying to remember the name of it. It's the Oxford. That's right. It's just the Oxford, four by five mm-hmm. note pocket, and essentially has a pocket in the front, a pocket in the back, pocket in the middle, and it's all just essentially for note cards. But you've got that hybrid wallet thing. It comes actually with like a pencil holder on the side that I just cut off because it's not that good of a pencil holder. Ooh. Oh my gosh. I know what, I know a pen that like, I can't believe it's not within eyesight right now. I feel like I lost my kid.
I'm saving that one for when Kaya turns 18.
It's the Lamy Pico pen. I heart this thing a lot. It's as far as capturing information, it's not as much like a sketching art tool or whatnot, but like this baby collapses down like this. Watch it. So now it's full size Transformers. Boom. Now it's short and it's safe. If you're for someone who carries stuff in your pocket, I love this thing because you can totally safely carry it in your pocket. It won't leak. I'm terrible. I've destroyed one by accident by putting it through the wash. Right. And yeah, this is horrible.
Lamy pens are not inexpensive,
dude. I know. And, what's funny, here's what sucks, is I did it twice. I brought it back to life the first time. Second time, couldn't do it. It would no longer open and close anymore. This one was close to dying. So I went through this phase this year of washing my pens. It's terrible. I soaked it in alcohol, like rubbing alcohol, and then I cleaned it and cleaned it and cleaned it, and it came back to life. So anyway, Lamy Pico Pen.
Lamy
and you pens. Can get it on Amazon.
Lamy pens are very nice. Anne has one as her ubiquitous capture pen, and it's a very, very nice pen. So yeah, they're like the Rolex of pens.
Wow, jeez.
What?
It's not quite the Rolex of pens, but you know.
Well, they're supposedly really, really nice to like. They handle well, and they give you really nice ink lines. And they're not for drawing; they're just for like writing. But it's a pleasure to use them, from what I understand.
Yes.
Yeah,
this is true. These are all true things.
That's all I meant, is that the comfort and it's a luxury.
Gotcha. I suppose. I bet Rolex has its reputation for a reason. I've never really contemplated like the values of a Rolex. So, but yeah, I bet they're pretty cool.
Yeah. I bet they feel really good on the wrist. I wouldn't know.
I wouldn't.
I'm a cartoonist. Okay, another All item right. on the list that I want to throw out there is not everybody who listens to our show has an iPhone, and I myself have an iPhone 4, which is no longer associated with my cellular service. I use it as a touch, but it's still, you know, even though it's 2 years old and so out of fashion, it still works really good, and until they update the operating system so mine can't, you know, be updated anymore, works pretty great for me. And one of the things I got with it, and one of the reasons I got it in the first place, is because, you know, these things are nowadays portable production studios in our pockets. Talked about this before, recorded the Thunder Punch Daily on my iPhone. And one of the things I got it for was to also record video, you know, streaming, you know, doing like you streaming of when I'm working on artwork, or doing just video captures of, like, I posted on YouTube recently, my process of doing one of my warm-up sketches. I did Blur from the Transformers, shot on this phone. How did I shoot it on this phone? Well, I got this funny little thing called a Glyph. Have you heard these, Rob? I'm sure you have.
Yes, I have. I actually own a Glyph.
Oh, cool. Yeah, these things are awesome. It's like $30. And what it is it's a little, you know, mount you can put on your phone, and then you can screw, it's got a, you know, a metallic thread here, and you can put it on a tripod. And I just mount it on a tripod and point the camera at whatever I'm doing. And it could just be sitting over my shoulder. I just got like a cheap, you know, regular photography tripod, like a, you know, like a dad one, not like a professional one. Just for taking pictures of the kids kind of thing. And it was like $10. And then I just mount this on there and I just put it over my shoulder while I'm working. I can record my process, or I can use it for when I'm doing events, like when I'm at the library and whatever. But that doesn't really apply to anybody listening. But if you wanted to stream your art day, if you have an iPhone, at least from 4 and on, where they did this funny design with the metal band around the sides and everything. This Glyph fits nice and snug you know, and you can hold it. I'm not even touching the phone now. It's holding it right in there, right? It also doubles up as a stand and whatever, you know. But it's, I got it specifically for my tripod. I'm sure that I got on Amazon a long time ago, I got a different tripod for smartphones, and it like fits, it's more of a universal one. It doesn't fit so snugly as this. But it's like you use with any phone, like an Android phone or whatever. But it was cheap plastic, and the threads for the tripod mount were plastic as well. And I thought, this is not going to last.
Ooh.
One of the things I like about this is it's a nice metallic, you know, threaded area in there. That's going to, that feels, it's really good build quality. And this thing's going to last for a long time, as long as I have this at any rate.
Oh yeah. And what's, that was like a, based on a successful Kickstarter, right?
Yeah. That's how I got mine. I pledged for the Kickstarter when I saw it, because I was like, that's perfect. That's why I got my phone. And I didn't know how I was going to mount it. And I was working on all these really clumsy, kludgy workarounds of like taking sticks and rubber bands and stuff, trying to get it mounted on something. But yeah, it just occurred to me as I was digging through my bag of like, what is in my bag every day? And this is in there every day in case I need to grab some video of something and I want to do a good job of it. So the glyph. I didn't know if we wanted to bring up graphics tablets for those who don't have them yet. And I feel weird recommending Wacom graphics tablets nowadays because I hear so many good things about the Monoprice tablets, which are dirt cheap.
That's interesting. Is it, I wonder if, do they have anything that competes with that, with the higher end Intos tablets? I wonder.
I just was skating over their website this afternoon as I was putting together the notes for this episode. And I wasn't really doing like a blow by blow spec comparison on these. But in terms of size, like you could like, okay, let's look at this. Here we go. 4x3 inches graphics tablet. $23.
What?
$23.
I'm looking at the price list.
Yeah.
Whoa.
8x6, which is, gosh, that's bigger than the one I've got. $35.
What? I paid $250. These prices are nuts, Jersey.
Yeah. But wait, there's more.
Oh my God.
I have not used.
They have to, I mean, seriously, do you know anyone who has used these?
I've talked with two people. Okay. I mean, this is purely anecdotal. I have not seen them myself. I have not used them myself. I've talked with two different people who have said they can't tell the difference between them and a Wacom Intuos line. Now, they're not Cintiqs, right? So, you know, Cintiq may be like the killer product that nobody can replicate. But it could be, I mean, at $23, I'm ready to just get one myself just to test it, you know, just to be my hocking around tablet.
Yeah. I wonder what the Linux support is for that. I mean, because, you know, you can do like a pretty inexpensive art workstation with one of these and like a little Linux netbook or something.
Yeah.
And that's totally portable.
Yeah.
I mean, pretty darn portable.
And that would be dirt cheap too.
Wow. I am super curious. Yeah, these price. I mean, okay. So for instance, on the large side of things, so a 12x9 is... $89?
Yeah. Isn't that outrageous? For a 12x9 tablet.
That's crazy. Yeah, my first Wacom tablet back in the 90s cost like $250 or $300. I think it was the Art Z parallel port version. But anyway.
Oh my God, parallel port. Wow.
Yep.
So yeah, I mean, there's is as you would say, Rob. There are pros and cons, and there's different advantages to both sides. Here is that one, Monoprice. I don't know what the software support is like. I don't know what the drivers are like. You know, you yourself were wondering aloud. I wonder how well supported it is on Linux. Whereas with Wacom or Wacom, whatever we call it, we know there's like a lot of infrastructure there. There's like a huge support chain there to find an answer to a problem with one of these devices. So. But yeah.
Oh yeah. What's funny? I just did a search to see if Monoprice tablets work on Ubuntu. But what I meant to say is Wacom has been, I mean, I've many, many people in the creative community have tested the heck out of those and
it's a mature.
I do feel no hesitation recommending any of the Wacom tablets.
But they are pricey. Yeah, they're still pricey. The Bamboo line is not bad though. We got an extra tablet for the house last year. We got a Bamboo, and it's really interesting because it has multi-touch on it, so you can actually use it as a trackpad. And it's got an interesting texture on it where it feels more like paper when you draw on it. It has like a little bit of resistance. So
interesting.
Which made my first thought was like, gosh, how long are the tips going to last on these? You know, because like how am I grinding them down by rubbing them on this rough surface? But on the other hand, there was a bit of a pleasure in feeling like I was drawing on paper rather than on that smooth plastic that's on my Intuos.
Cool. But
anyway, speaking of being mobile and portable, I wanted to throw out too that, you know, another link right up in the show notes is I wanted to hear, you know, have you had more time to play with the Galaxy Note 10.1, Rob? You've had it for a few weeks now.
Yeah, I have. I am doing a design project on it now. My main foray with it was 24-hour comic day, and I've done, you know, I've used it for taking notes and doing some quick sketches since, and I've been doing a lot of because I do still have an iPad, and so I was doing a bit of like, can I get this thing set up equivalently to be as productive with all the different tasks that I am on the iPad with this. And so far it's mainly like it wins hands down when it comes to sketching. And one thing I did find, well, cause obviously, I mean, it has the huge advantage of the pressure sensitivity and whatnot. I'm looking for the, my pen that I bought. I bought this external pen that's actually meant for the Galaxy Note phone. Uh-huh. And it's okay. It's not as like the device, like it doesn't register as many levels of pressure sensitivity with that pen.
Interesting.
Yeah, really interesting, which is depending on the application can be more noticeable than others. But for instance, oh gosh, the app that you recommended Layer Paint. Thank you. Layer Paint. It's really noticeable. The difference, the native pen that comes, it's inserted into the Galaxy Note 10.1 into one of the corners. You pop it out. I was paranoid not having sight unseen, not used it or whatnot. I thought, oh, that thing's going to be small.
Yeah.
And I bet it's going to bug me. So I better just get the big pen. The pen that comes with it is awesome.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, it has a pretty good feel.
It does. They I guess they did some design changes on it. I never used the original one, but I heard bad things about the first Note S Pen. But on the new one, it feels really good in the hand.
Well, what's funny is the pen that I bought actually holds an original Note S Pen inside of it. It just kind of docks it, and then you clamp a little cap over it, and it looks like a big pen. But anyway, it's really just a jacket. But where that's okay. So I'll carry it to meetings and I'll take notes with it now. But anyway, I really dig the device. I think it's awesome. And, it's a good art production tool.
I'm finding that I haven't shared a lot of this stuff publicly, but I've been keeping a sketchbook in it, you know, using the, Papyrus app, which is a sketching, or it's ostensibly a note gathering tool. It's like to be used like Evernote, or rather it's actually it has a lot of similarities. It has a lot of similarities to Sketch. Actually, it's more like Sketch, where it's like you can draw but then everything's vector, and you can, and the nice thing is it's got this really cool feature where I can be drawing and then you can set it to where if I swipe with my finger, that's an eraser, but if I use the S Pen, once the pen's in contact with the screen, it only registers the S Pen, so it's not going to pick up spurious touches from my palm or wrist. But yep. Then I can, if I didn't like something I drew, just swipe it with my finger, and then it's like, boom, it's gone. It erased. So I don't have to erase like this. It erases like the entire line kind of thing.
So what kind of sketches are you doing with this? And
I wish I had some. I just posted on Instagram, and I'll link to it in the show notes. I posted on Instagram where I was sketching a character, and Anne said it was too scary, so she said, draw something less scary, and so I drew Captain Cat. And if you go to my Instagram feed, it's instagram.com/jerseydrows. You can find it there, and you can see what kind of lines you can get out. It's got pressure sensitivity. Everything's vector, infinite-sized pages, you know? So you can just keep zooming out and out and out and out and out and just keep drawing until whenever. Or you can add multiple pages if you feel like, oh, I need some way to contain this. But anyway, Papyrus Beta, the guy's still adding more features to it. And if he can add the functionality that Manga Studio has where you can... erase a vector line to the point of intersection with another line. And if he can add layer support, those two things. And I emailed him to say, if you add these two things, you've got a dynamite drawing app on your hands. You can market this thing to artists because it's vector and because it's got the pressure sensitivity of the note of the S Pen. Oh my gosh, that thing, it does beautiful lines. Beautiful lines.
Really?
Oh, I love it for drawing, but the only problem is it doesn't have layer support. So it has to be relegated to a sketching app, an idea grabbing app, and not an actual drawing app. But if he added layer support and that erase to the point of intersection feature, it could be my number one with a bullet recommendation for a line drawing tool. I mean, just perfect for that. So, Papyrus Beta is where I've been keeping a lot of my sketching notes. And then the cool thing is, you know, you can also do handwritten notes. I've been keeping like journal notes of like, here's story ideas and then here's drawing ideas. And it's vector, so they're really small files. So, I mean, yeah, I would still recommend the Galaxy Note 10.1 for anybody who's got $500 of discretionary income to spend on a digital sketching tablet. Now, here was my observation that I wanted to make about it is I've been looking into peripherals for it as a replacement for a laptop. Because whenever I go do teaching gigs, I've got to take my laptop because it's got all my presentations on it. It's the only thing I can plug into a digital projector, right? So I got my VGA out. So I found a composite video out for the Galaxy Note for $35. And then I was thinking, if I just get that and then get $35 on a Bluetooth keyboard, this thing is not only a portable sketchbook, but it's like an under 3-pound laptop that I can take wherever I need to go. And I just load up all my presentations on it using Google presentations. Don't have to count on Wi-Fi then. And yeah, now I've got this razor thin thing that's like not only a sketchbook, a production studio, and it's teaching kit all at the same time.
Yeah, it's a pretty amazing tool. I agree. I mean, it's definitely expensive, but it depends on what kind of things you're evaluating it against. I mean, versus like, well, if you're in the market for a tablet and you happen to want pressure sensitivity, then it wins over everything. And then if you're thinking about, well, things like I sold my ModBook to fund my purchase and I don't regret it. You know, the ModBook was a full up Mac OS X. I had Lion installed on it and it was awesome. But I mean, it did not have this battery life.
That's
and
the thing.
The portability.
The portability and battery life are huge for that thing because you can get 8 hours out of that thing easy and it weighs next to nothing. There's other cons, right? It's like, yeah, it's not a full desktop operating system like you can get on a laptop. You know, the build quality of Samsung is a little suspect. I mean, it's a little bit of a creaky machine, right? Although Samsung just recently did that video where they're showing how much rigorous testing all their devices go through, and everybody made a lot of hay out of that, you know, mechanical butt that sits on the phones over and over again. But anyway, there's pros and cons to it. But yeah, if you're in the market for a tablet, you know, supposedly Photoshop Touch for iOS release pressure sensitivity with certain kinds of pens. Interesting. But it's native on this Android device. And I'm still loving that device. Absolutely adore it. So I want to get through a few more. Do we want to talk about services? I want to blast through a couple book recommendations real quick, and then we can go through services.
Oh yeah.
Okay. Big one, Making Comics by Scott McCloud. If you don't own this already, it's a great book, great resource that you go to again and again and again for Making Comics. It will be linked in the show notes. It's nerdy stuff. It's McCloud, right? He loves his charts. And but at the same time, it's great fuel for getting you thinking. Like, here's his you know, like the additive primary or additive colors, primary colors, red and blue make green. He does this with emotions on faces, and it's by no means precise, but it is a great thinking exercise. And like, it's like both practical and conceptual at the same time. It's a great book. Lots of people have recommended it. Drawing Words and Writing Pictures by Jessica Abel and Matt Madden is a great resource to drawing comics. They got a follow-up book called Mastering Comics, which just came out recently. And then I would also throw in there Vanishing Point, Perspective for Comics from the Ground Up, which is an awesome, awesome book for helping you wrap your brain around 1 point, 2 point, 3 point, even 5 point perspective. These are all books that would just be.
What's this 5-point perspective? What universe is that in? Anyway,
it's a thing, and it's in there.
No, that's funny. No, that is really cool. Playing with perspective is pretty awesome. Not that I incorporate in comics a lot, but it is great for if you're doing production art for backgrounds in a video game, for instance, and you need a consistent perspective to in relationship to the props and the characters and all that. That's cool. So, and what's that book called again? Because I'm
Vanishing Point.
I don't have that one.
Perspective for Comics from the Ground Up. It's a great book. And even if you don't draw in perspective a lot, because these days with things like Manga Studio and its perspective tool, even I am not drawing in proper mathematical hand-drawn perspective as much as I used to. I still think it's a good thing to have a conceptual awareness of and how it works so you can tell mm-hmm. when it's been, how, even if you're using things like Google SketchUp, it's a good idea to have like a fundamental understanding of how perspective works so you can tell how to use it properly. Do you want to talk about some services?
Well, let's see. Services are an interesting, if you're being gifted or gifting a service, I mean, it's there's things that I find indispensable in my toolkit, no doubt. Like I pay for Evernote. I use it quite a bit. Even though what's funny is like how I use Evernote has changed over the years, but it's still like this really great go-to tool. Especially if you want to, just visually capture notes, because as you mentioned, like whether it's a whiteboard for something cool that you doodled or, you know, an example from like if you're teaching a class or doing a workshop, or if you, happen to take a lot of notes on note cards and you just, take snapshots of them. Yeah. It's pretty, pretty amazing. I have noticed, I can be a bit, I had a deck of note cards. Like actually I was going through last night. I don't know how many of this is. It's probably like, I don't know, 30, but it does. The app does blow up on iOS. If you try to capture 30 things, 30 images into one note.
Good to know.
So I don't know, but.
So is that something where you would want to just like scan them then and then drop them in on a desktop?
No, actually I have a separate app that I was using for that. It's called, PDF, snap to PDF.
Snap to PDF.
Snap the letter two and then PDF.
Okay.
And it is not the aesthetic iOS app winner of the year, but it's a hard worker.
Cool.
Does the job.
So you can grab like all these notes, put them in a PDF form, and then just scoot them over to Evernote.
Yes, exactly.
Does it do multi-page PDFs then?
Yeah, it does totally. So I think you've seen this. I use this app to capture a lot of notes that I had for the design series. Didn't I share that PDF with you?
Yeah, you did. You did.
So,
okay. Anyway. Cool. Snap to PDF.
Yep.
Another one that I want to throw in here. I don't know why I put this under services. I think I did this by accident. Long arm stapler for binding mini comics. We were extolling the virtues of mini comics, right? And a long arm stapler, you can get it for like $30. And, but I've had mine for, I bought my first one 20 years ago. And then something happened to that. So I think we bought this newest one like about 10 years ago. But they'll last, there's a stapler. It's a rugged tool. It's going to last you a long time. No cartoonist, I think, an indie cartoonist is not properly equipped without one. And they make stapling and binding mini comics infinitely easier. And then to go on this mini comics thing just a little bit further, screen printing kits. You can get a screen printing kit for like as low as $40, but the ultimate screen printing kit you can get from Speedball is $90. And when I first started screen printing the covers of my books, Ann and I, when we were doing the Rocketosaurus mini comics and Dino Love mini comics, we were screen printing them in our bathroom. You know, we would just have like a small apartment, a 2-bedroom apartment. And we were just, you know, hanging up the equipment in the bathroom, you know, emulsifying the screens in the bathroom and, you know, drying them in there and then burning the screens in there and printing them on our dining room table. So you don't need like a big fancy studio in order to start doing screen printed covers if you want to get into that. And
go ahead. Oh, my gosh. I'm really glad you mentioned that. So do you have a recommendation? Like, is this how complete is this kit as far as getting into doing the screen printing covers?
I'm glad you asked. It's enough to get you started if you want to start with a simple design, because it starts you out with a fabric printing screen, which has a lower, to use something we're all familiar with, it has a lower DPI. Okay. So it's like 72 DPI screen. It's a different thread count, but it's a lower thread count, which means that you can do lower resolution images, which is great for fabric printing, great for JPEGs on the web, not so great for printing on paper. But if your design is simple, it'll look okay. But if you start getting into like really delicate line work, and I would never advise anybody who's new to screen printing to try out something with like a lot of elaborate line work and like really tight registration, you're gonna hate doing it. Let yourself go through a couple different kinds of designs, simple designs first, and then work your way up to getting to more elaborate and intricate stuff. But if you want to do something with like a higher density or a higher DPI, you want to get an aluminum stretched frame, which you can get from dickblick.com. It'll be linked in the show notes. They run for anywhere from $20 to $40. And you want to get into like 195 thread count or higher. So like 195 to 200 is what Ann and I use for books like this, Boulder and Fleet, which has pretty crisp resolution, but I intentionally did things to the design to give it more of a distressed look. I intentionally put like flecks of ink into the design to give it like a distressed t-shirt kind of look. But you can see that there's a crispness to like Fleet's wings there and Boulder's fur, which I wouldn't be able to pull off on the screen that you get with the Ultimate Starter Kit. So the Ultimate Starter Kit would run you about 90. That gives you the emulsion. That gives you a couple different jars of ink to start testing on. It gives you a screen, gives you a squeegee, gives you everything you need to actually start screen printing that day. But if you want to do anything with on paper and do a nice job of it, you definitely want to invest in one or two aluminum stretched frames. And then to clean them, you just take them down to the car wash, and you use just one of those spray guns you use to the do-it-yourself car wash. The kit comes with the cleaning solution. You use an old toothbrush and brush on the cleaning solution, let it sit 5 minutes, and spray it off with one of those industrial sprayers. And then if you take care of it, the screen will last you for years and years and years. We've had ours for years. Granted, we don't do a ton of printing on it, but it is nice for giving your mini comics that like little arty touch.
It is interesting as a catalyst. I mean, the mini comics is a project, a desire to do it and to have, to want to accomplish some kind of result. Like, I mean, that unites a whole ton of these different gift ideas and whatnot.
Yeah. Also, where we get our paper is from French's Paper, which we will link to in the show notes. Expensive paper, but it's really nice. It holds the ink really well because this ink was put on really thick. You know, it's covering a lot of area, which can warp a lot of papers, right? Like when you get paper wet, it does that stuff. Yeah, so if you use just like construction paper or like cardstock from Kinko's.
It's almost like a watercolor problem then, because you're saturating the paper so much.
You're saturating the paper, and the stuff you get from French's Paper feels like a standard cardstock to the naked eye, but it takes ink so well, it doesn't warp that much, even though you're putting it all thick. So, but it is a little bit pricey as paper goes. So, it's not something that you want to just get just a doodle on. You get it for specific printing projects. So.
Okay, cool. What else? Do we, anything? Oh gosh. What other services were you thinking of?
You were talking about Evernote paying for it as a premium service, which I mean, as much as I'm using Evernote more and more, I can see if I get to the edge of the free usage that I might have to pay for this someday, because it is immensely useful as a tool. The other one that I've learned to really love, and if the day comes, I will pay for it, is Box.com. As cloud storage options go, I'm really falling in love with that one. Now, when I got my Galaxy Note, I got 2 years of Dropbox, and I think when I signed up for the iOS app for Box.com, I got 2 years of 50 gigabytes of free storage. So like that's like $19 a month normally. But they always run these incentive deals where if you sign up through the Android app or you sign up through the iOS app or you sign up through this new device, an Android device, you get X amount of storage for free for several years. And I'll tell you what I love about Box.com over the other services is it works just like Dropbox. You know, you got a folder on your desktop that you just sync with it for files. And working in two different studios for the last 3 months, I found that to be a huge, huge help, right? I'm working on the file at home, save it to my Box document, and then I can go to my office on campus, open it right up as if you know, it was stored locally, which it is. But I sent in a file to an art director for a freelance gig, and there was a really tight deadline on it. Like, they needed it by end of the day Tuesday. And so I sent it to him, emailed them the link. Here is on my Box account. And, you know, normally I would have to, like, kind of cross my fingers. I hope they got the mail and hope that they send me a confirmation. Like, thanks so much, we got it. Sometimes they don't do that. But with Box, you can get a notification in your inbox saying, your file was downloaded, right? Mm. So-and-so downloaded your file. And it'll even send you notifications when you've updated your own files. So, like, I'll have, like, a Box, other Box accounts. I've got one for that I got through the University of Michigan for my new job as artist in residence. So created a shared folder between that account and my home account. And then whenever I save a file to that one in the University of Michigan, I get an email notification saying, somebody just saved a file to your Box account. So I know that it's been saved. I get confirmation that it has been saved, and it's not just showing me on my desktop that it seems to have been saved. No, I get a full confirmation that this file is now there and you will have access to it when you get home. I love that feature.
That's pretty cool. We'd have to try out Box.
But you get 5 gigs for free. If you want to get more than that, then it gets pricey. $20 a month for 50 gigs. But another thing I was thinking about, I mean, like, is I wanted to close out, and we're getting really close to the edge here of how much time we should be spending on this episode.
Okay.
I want to close out with free options. And one of the things that I was thinking about as a hack is, you know, everybody's launching a cloud service now. Amazon's got one. Microsoft's got SkyDrive. Google's got Google Drive. Then you've got Dropbox, Box.com. There's another one that I forget the name of that's pretty popular, too. Just look for cloud storage and you'll see tons of options. And I was wondering if, like, as a hack to not have to pay for, you know, premium services, if you just wanted to use each different cloud storage thing as saving different kinds of media or different project files. Like, so Dropbox is my service that I use for this book. Box.com is the one I use for freelance work. You know, SkyDrive is for this book, right? And you can use them as a way to sync all your files across machines or even just as like a backup for lots of different projects without having to pay for any premium stuff. That could be a free hack to do as everybody's jockeying for position. I mean, obviously you should pay for value, but I'm just saying that for those who are like going like, well, I can't afford $20 a month for 50 gigs of storage. Totally understand. But yeah, it seems like everybody's lining up for this is the new frontier is cloud storage. And that's a boon for us in a way.
Oh yeah. And as far as workflow, it's amazingly handy. I mean, again, as soon as you have two devices and as soon as you want to work on the same project on two devices, cloud storage, it is such a magical, wonderful sanity saver because you can go from, like I can do an outline for, back when I contributed more to the Lean Into Art outlines or whatnot, I could do an outline quick on my, tablet device. I could do a mind map, export it to OPML or whatnot, and save it in Dropbox. And if I actually, I could be collaborating too. So not only is it in Dropbox where I can open it up somewhere, but then I could be sharing it with Jersey in a shared folder and all that. And it's pretty awesome. And that's exactly when you were like, oh, okay. Yeah, this is way better than emailing and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, and especially like Dropbox even has growl notifications where it can just like pop up a little thing on your screen like Rob just uploaded a thing to your shared folder, just so you know, you've been notified that it's there. And also I will say this for Box too, its iOS and Android apps are really nice. They recently updated it so it will give you TIFF previews and I think even PSD previews, even though it takes a little while for it to spool it up. But so I can look at my Galaxy Note to say like, oh, well, I'll pull up the pencils for this thing. I can import it into any of my drawing apps there, or I can just take a look at it real quick. Like if I want to show somebody like, hey, look what I did today, which, you know, sometimes you want to do when you get home from work. So the mobile apps for Box.com are really nice as well. So,
super cool. So should we have a few ideas for free things. Do we have a,
I got a place I want to start with this. So okay. I did a post on Google Plus a few weeks back about, which was a tutorial on how we do the Lean Into Art show using Google Plus Hangouts and Audio Hijack Pro and how we create an audio and video version of the show for very, very little startup cost. And we use Audio Hijack Pro, which is about $33. It's at Rogue Amoeba Software or RogueAmoeba.com. Let me check. Where is it?
Well, they picked a really good name. So if you search for Rogue Amoeba, yeah. I mean, you're probably not going to find a squatter.
Or Audio Hijack Pro. So Audio Hijack Pro is this awesome app. I think it's worth every penny of $30 because it allows you to grab audio from any source, and it allows you to do some really, really cool workarounds to loop audio to different sources. That's the main application I use to be able to pump in the stingers, the musical interludes for the show, as well as grab mine and Rob's audio out of the show and pump it all into one audio file, which then can export as a one-take show. It really cuts down on production time on making the Lead Tart show in terms of, you know, actual cutting of audio and video. I mean, there's lots of production time in terms of building the show and coming up with ideas for the show, but in terms of like actual like post-production time, it's cut a lot out of it. But not everybody wants to spend $30 on an audio thing. If you want to do anything like with Google Plus Hangouts and do any kind of journaling or your own kinds of shows like what Marshall
Coacher?
Yeah. I always trip at the
I say it two different ways. I say sometimes I say Marshall Coacher, and some days I say Marshall Coacher.
He's at plexhop.com and he started doing his own show modeling kind of like the audience that we wanted to speak to with Lena Tart in the first place. And so if you want to do something like that, Audio Hijack Pro is great. But if you don't have that kind of money, then Audacity is free. Audacity is free. And you could do not quite as much stuff as you can with Audio Hijack Pro, but you can at least start grabbing audio, and you can use something like SoundFlower, or I'm sure there's Windows or Linux options to route audio from one application to another. I remember being able to do this with Skype as early as 2003 or 2005. So I'm sure there's free options out there to this day, but the easy and Macintosh version would be Audio Hijack Pro, but the free version would be Audacity, which works in Windows and on the Mac. What other free ones do you got?
Well, let's see. It's an OS X app, but and it's a text editor, so I don't know how many of you visual artists are into coding or whatnot, but I think a few of you are, actually, from what I can tell on Twitter and whatnot. But TextMate is now free and open source. It has been for months, and it's been a go-to editor for me for a few years now. Maybe a couple of years now. I was skating by and just holding off. I actually bought a license for it before it went open source. But it's a really great tool because it's super adaptable to all sorts of different languages. And like, so even if you are like a blogger and you've heard about like Markdown and you want to, you know, efficiently create blog posts with it, because more and more actually CMSs are supporting Markdown. So you can write a whole blog post that will be, it looks like text, but it'll be actually formatted as great HTML because you're actually enhancing the text a little bit with some Markdown syntax, which doesn't make the text look weird and codey too much. TextMate supports that in a bajillion other languages, and it's free, and it's on GitHub. I forget what the URL is. I think it's like github.com/textmate/textmate.
Well, we'll link to it in the show notes.
Yeah.
Speaking of programs made in that ethos, there's GIMP, which I've been using more and more lately. GIMP is I forget what it's called, generic image manipulation program, something like that. Basically open source free version of Photoshop. And, you know, I got my Adobe products. I like my Adobe products, but there's a problem with Adobe products is that they are very restrictive in the licensing and how many machines you can actually install them on. They're very, very tight-fisted about that. You can argue pro or con for that, you know, but the problem is that, you know, it's like I've got a laptop, I've got a desktop, and sometimes I want to do editing on either machine. Photoshop says, hey, this has already been installed on two of your machines in your house. You don't get to put it on X amount of machines. So for whatever reason, I can't put it on my laptop, which sometimes it's easier. It's in another part of my studio. I just want to open up something and do a quick edit on that and then save it. So I put GIMP on it, and I've been using GIMP as an editor on my laptop, and it's not bad. It's pretty darn good, and something that I want to put on my list for to-dos for 2013 is try to do more in GIMP to try to wean myself off of Photoshop. The Galaxy Note was the first clue into this thing, this idea that I don't have to live in the Adobe ecosystem if I don't want to. Knowing that there's other programs out there that do exactly what I want. Like, well, Manga Studio too. Manga Studio was a lightning bolt moment where I realized that, oh, you can build a program that can actually handle ink lines really, really well. Photoshop does it pretty good, but man, Manga Studio just kicks its butt in terms of how it handles ink lines, how it replicates natural ink lines. So that's another one I put on my list is Manga Studio. There was just a sale, sadly. We're past that point where they're selling it for $30 on Black Friday. But you can still find it on Amazon for $90. I'd pay $90 for it, knowing what I know about it now. I love it. But going back to free, GIMP is pretty darn good. You don't have to buy Photoshop.
I would add to that. So GIMP is a really great bitmap-based artwork tool. And sort of the Photoshop equivalent, the equivalent for Illustrator would be Inkscape. That is a great free and open source editor. Lastly, this doesn't have to be last in this category, but I really do want to mention, if you're in a situation where maybe you're not on a Mac and you're thinking about upgrading or whatnot, if you have compatible hardware, living with an open source operating system is far easier and less geeky than ever, right? I have a netbook that I happen to just to keep a foot in the world of Ubuntu. So I think if you go to canonical.com or ubuntu.org, you'll be able to go download that for free and, you know, burn it to a disk and, or burn it to a, or not burn it or expand it to a thumb drive and install away.
Yeah.
It's pretty great.
I've played with Ubuntu, and I think it was a lot prettier than I expected. I think there's like a lot of expectations that us normals, I'll count myself among them, we think of, like, when we hear the word Linux, we think of command line kind of stuff. But I was pleasantly surprised when we loaded it up on this old Hewlett Packard that we got from our grandparents. You know, it's like, well, we don't know what to do with this thing. So we're like, hey, let's just turn it into a Linux machine and play with it. And when it loaded up, I was like, this is really pretty. Like, this is prettier than Windows, actually. So, yeah, really pleasantly surprised, very user-friendly.
It's cool. And it's kind of fun because, I mean, it's free, but like two new versions of it come out per year. There's a version in October and a version in April. So yeah, we're still pretty fresh off of a very new version. And like every 2 years, they do an LTS version, long-term support. So if you don't want to like gamble with all the new fancy things that keep coming out, you can just stick to one of the LTS versions. And I think that was April of this year. So that's still pretty fresh.
That's cool. I'm glad we got to kind of wrap with like some open source free options for people rather than turn this into like hooray for capitalism. As much as I love our country, you know, capitalism has its pros and cons as well. And sometimes celebrating free and open things can be a nice way to celebrate the season as well, right?
Mm-hmm. Certainly.
And then if you contribute or if you participate in free and open source, a great way you can contribute to the actual developers, right? I mean, can't you contribute to, you can donate to the Ubuntu team to, you know, keep it going?
Well, yeah. I mean, so Ubuntu is a situation where they were founded by what's his name? Mark Shuttlesworth. I mean, so he's quite the capitalist. Yeah. So you familiar with VeriSign? So yes. If you wanted to buy like an SSL certificate, you could buy it from VeriSign. Like that's like kind of like the big name brand and you pay sort of a premium for that. He had a competitor to VeriSign called Thought, Thawte, I believe is who he owned. Sold it off and then formed Canonical and decided to do like a very humanitarian approach to having like free resources that it's pretty awesome. Like there's third world, a lot of people in situations that can't afford our current hardware and whatnot, they still can benefit from the capabilities of computing. And so he made an operating system that would be usable for a wide audience, for, you know, and similar in mission to, like, you know, like one laptop per child and all that. And so he's got a free operating system, made a mission of, like, I was going to make Linux usable and whatnot. And he's funded that. But then Canonical on top of it, sorry for my big rant, is essentially he sells services to large organizations where it's like, you know what? You want to run on a lower cost operating system, you know, Corporation A or Corporation B, we'll support you, you know, and we'll teach you how to use it and whatever. So he sells services basically in hosting. And so that's how he funds Ubuntu. I know there's ways to donate as well. I think you can buy merchandise and stuff, but, so that's like one of the big flagship open source projects, but there's others that are more just, you know, one or two people that could, you know, ask for donation support and stuff. So
cool. So we'll link to all of this stuff in the show notes, including some things that we didn't have time to mention today, because we're actually closing in on 2 hours, Rob. We're 10 minutes away from 2 hours. And I'm worried what the Hangouts is going to do with our video. So I tell you what, I think we're going to bypass takeaways this week and tag it on for next week.
Okay.
Because we got some announcements to throw out very quickly at the end. So, okay. Schedule. The show will be archived at leanintoart.com, and we are going to do one more episode this year, and then we're going to take a couple weeks off. So we plan on recording on the 11th of December, and then the rest of the following two and a half weeks, we will not be broadcasting shows while we take a little bit of time off for the holidays. And we're also going to investigate doing, and we hinted at this a couple episodes ago, going into a twice monthly schedule. But fear not, for those who really enjoy the show, we're still going to be doing extra shows in between, but they're only going to be available through our mailing list. So we should make an announcement about that, is that we've got a new extra show coming up that's only going to be available to people who subscribe to our mailing list. And you can do that at leanintoart.com. There's like an email newsletter link there. Sign up. We're not going to spam you. We're just going to occasionally send out a newsletter with extra shows in there. So it's a way to say, hey, if you really enjoy the stuff, we'll still keep creating the content on a regular basis. But for those for the regular free feed, we're talking about going to a bi-weekly schedule starting in January. But, so with that out of the way, then we got to say, if folks really enjoyed this show, and if you really think that we do a good job putting together a weekly thing for you to listen to and get your brain churning on this art stuff, maybe inspire you a little bit, and you want to thank us somehow, well, you could send us an email to leanintoart@gmail.com. You could send us a curveball, or you could send us just like a thank you, or you could go to iTunes and give us a star review. It's a nice anonymous free way to support the show, help us be seen by more people. Another way you could help us out is the season of creative challenges at leanintoart.com/workshops. This is ending soon, Rob, right?
Yes, we did. It's ending soon, yet it is extended. We were planning on possibly ending it, you know, in early December. So we didn't want to shut it down like right after the challenging month of November, because hey, maybe you wanted to do a little victory lap, or you know, say, oh, you know, and I've been so focused on my challenge, I didn't realize there was a sale or whatever. Anyway, so we extended it actually past the holiday. So you have a chance to, you know, give yourself a workshop, or, you know, give someone that you think would enjoy it a workshop. That's actually a part of our, it's on the form actually. If you are, if this is a gift, you can include that information there. Let's see, which workshop shall we feature today, Jersey?
I'm going to say that we were talking about Photoshop. Those who do have Photoshop, we have a Photoshop coloring class in there, yes. Coloring in Adobe Photoshop Elements in the cheaper version. And then also we could do a Adobe 1-2 Punch, is that we've got lettering in Adobe Illustrator.
Ooh, yes.
Those are both $10.
And techniques that do actually apply to other applications as well. I mean, yeah, the keyboard shortcuts may be different in GIMP and whatnot, but the techniques that actually Jersey teaches both classes. So, they're both awesome. I have benefited from sitting in Jersey's classes, and I noticed that even in, like, for instance, Manga Studio, Jersey's tips regarding Illustrator are super helpful for word ballooning and all that as well.
So yeah, and those are just two of a whole mess of workshops that are available at leanintoart.com/workshops. $10 for an hour or more worth of content. And every purchase comes with 13 hours of bonus content in the way of our Creative Topics Variety Pack, which you can find in the same link that I mentioned before. You can browse for yourself what comes in there, but you get 13 hours of extra stuff just for purchasing 1 hour of content. This is only going on for a couple more weeks. Mm-hmm. And then it's going to go back to regular prices. So, you know, in this season of giving, give to yourself or give to a friend at leanintoart.com/workshops. Mm-hmm. And then every instructor gets a cut of that sale. And then a little bit is left behind to cover our operating costs and hosting all of this media content. No DRM on the files and the links never expire. So with that, I will say, Rob, thank you for doing this episode with me.
Yeah, thank you, Jersey. Yeah, you were right to cut us off in the beginning there because this is a big one.
Yeah.
So, but there's a lot of fun stuff, and I'll as always, you can anyone listening, you can let us know what you think. Go to leanintoart.com and hit the contact link at the bottom of the page, and you can ping us there, or you can hit us up at Gmail. We're just leanintoart@gmail.com.
Yep.
Let us know what you think.
And don't forget to let us know if we have permission to read your email on the air.
Ah, that helps as well.
Yes. Okay. Well, we will be back next week for the final episode of the year. And until then, I have been Jersey Drozd of leanintoart.com and Jersey on Twitter.
And I have been Rob Stenzinger, also of leanintoart.com and Rob Stenzinger on Twitter.
Okay, bye.
Show notes for this episode can be found at leanintoart.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at the user leanintoart, and you can reach us via email at leanintoart@gmail.com. And remember, leaners aren't wieners. Thanks for listening.